futuro. To people who are against these mandates, I simply state, again, reminding them about what is a right and what is a privilege. And yes, you have a right to make a decision about your own health, but you don't have the privilege to expose someone else to danger. Uno, dos,
tres. Welcome to In the Thick, a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, solo hosting today while Maria Hinojosa is reporting. But today, I am joined by two amazingly great guests who are going to get us up to speed with the latest on the coronavirus pandemic. From Haslett, Texas, is Dr. Bianca Soria Olmos, who's a pediatrician at Cook Children's Pediatrics. Hey, Dr. Bianca.
Hello.
And from Los Angeles, California, is Dr. Darian Sutton, emergency medicine physician and medical contributor for ABC News. Welcome to the show, Dr. Darian.
Thank you so much.
And before we get to the conversation, just a reminder for our listeners that we're still recording remotely, so you may hear some background noise, dogs, cats, hospital noises, sirens. It's what life is during this pandemic. We also want to acknowledge the ongoing breaking news we are hearing out of Afghanistan, Haiti, and Lebanon. Maria and I will be covering some of the latest in our Friday sound off, but our hearts go out to all the people experiencing these intense moments of loss. All right. Good doctors, we are over a year and a half into this pandemic. There is now a fourth wave of the coronavirus driven by the Delta variant. Cases are surging in the United States, and the director of the National Institutes of Health warned that cases could soon rise to over 200,000 a day. As of Monday morning, about 50% of Americans are fully vaccinated, but we're seeing cases rise all across the country with surges in hospitalization and deaths among the unvaccinated. And it feels like the worst type of deja vu. We're hearing heartbreaking stories as hospitals reach their breaking point. Again, intensive care unit beds are hard to find. Healthcare workers are experiencing burnout again. But before we get into the latest surge and issues with vaccinations, we want to start with a temperature check. Basically, you both have been on the front line as healthcare workers throughout this devastating pandemic. I just want to thank you. My mom is an emergency room nurse from New York City. She's been there for 30, 40 years. She's kind of come back and stepped in, given vaccines and telling me the stories of her fellow healthcare workers in New York City. So I know it's a lot. Thank you so much for what you do. So I'm going to start with you, Bianca. How are you holding up?
Well, it definitely has been hard for all of the many reasons you just described. We're on top of what this wave has brought. It's made it a little bit more difficult, I would say, for my colleagues in pediatric medicine. We definitely were witness to a lot of what our adult colleagues had to deal with in the first waves. And, you know, the downside now is you got to remember there's a lot of children that are not yet eligible for the vaccine.
Yeah.
So right now in pediatrics, we're worried, we're busy, we're seeing a surge of other illnesses that typically don't come in the summer.
Yeah.
And so the combination of that among the stresses of the start to school and the back to school season is definitely putting pediatricians in a little bit tougher situation than we were at probably with the prior surges.
What about you, Dr. Darian? How are you feeling in general?
To put it simply, exhausted. You know, as this is the fourth surge, we have to acknowledge that as physicians and as healthcare providers, we are also human. Mm. And I feel as though we have been running in this race, trying our best, and we thought we had a glimmer of hope and a glimpse at an opportunity to divert the direction of this pandemic with the rollout of vaccines. And what we quickly realized was that we were up against a lot more than just COVID-19, which I'm referring to misinformation. As we try to fight this pandemic and this virus, but also try to dispel all of these rumors, these myths, and this inaccurate information that's constantly being spread about COVID-19.
You know, there's enough that we can do to say, like, thank you, thank you, thank you, but you are both human beings, and it's just been hard. I mean, the toll must be just mentally exhausting. Is that what you feel, Dr. Bianca?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that mentally exhausting because of the duration of this, of course. But I will say that the fact that us as pediatricians didn't necessarily get the physical exhaustion that came with the first waves.
Yeah.
The current waves are definitely proving otherwise. And physical exhaustion as well as mental exhaustion is definitely occurring right now.
Yeah. You know, we really want to get deep into what is keeping people from getting vaccinated. And something that's been personally frustrating me is all this talk about vaccine hesitancy among communities of color, and how the narrative puts the pressure on individuals when we know historically it has been systems that have failed Black and brown communities. And it's been reported how for many, it's logistical hurdles rather than ideological reasons for delaying vaccinations. So Dr. Rhea Boyd was on NPR earlier this month to talk about her public health campaign, The Conversation Between Us, About Us, to speak with underserved communities about the vaccine. So let's take a listen.
Accessibility is absolutely still an issue. How I've been framing it for people is that availability and accessibility are not the same thing. So even though the Biden administration has really taken on Herculean efforts to make sure that every American lives within 5 miles of a vaccination and that folks can get vaccinations in common community-based sites, that doesn't mean that everybody can actually access vaccination, right? 5 miles sounds pretty close if you have a car or if you live near public transit. But if you live in rural America and you have to walk those 5 miles, you might think twice about whether or not that's an accessible vaccine to you. Similarly, we see people have real barriers around not being able to take time away from their childcare duties to get vaccinated and around paid sick leave. They worry about their job security if they were to ask for time off, should they have some of the common side effects that makes them need to stay home a little longer.
Yeah. Darian, what are the true concerns or barriers that you're hearing from patients when it comes to getting vaccinated? I know you mentioned disinformation and misinformation, but are there other concerns and realities that you can share?
You know, I think that speaker pointed to something really, really poignant, which is that many times when I'm talking to patients about their hesitance or their time to deliberation on whether or not they want to get a vaccine, I'm realizing in that moment that this is the first time they're having a conversation with a provider and we're sitting in an emergency room. Sometimes in media, and sometimes on the grand scheme of things, we forget the privilege and access that many of us have, which is simply access to healthcare. And patients, unfortunately, many of whom are people of color, don't have that access that is constantly talked about. And by that, I mean, when we say, oh, you might have a side effect of this vaccine, and if you do, talk to your provider, that's just simply not an option for many people that exist in this world and are trying to just survive. And so for me, it's always figuring out how to position that message to provide a point of expertise from my own experience. But also, I do realize the limits to that, which is that not every single person has a provider that they can simply ask a question to. And that's what leads people to looking for other sources of information that may not be backed in science.
That's a good point. What about you, Bianca? What are your thoughts?
Right. So, you know, I completely agree with Darian. And honestly, as a pediatric provider, we deal with vaccine, quote unquote, hesitancy in our daily lives, right? I have to dispel the myths and the misinformation of vaccines that are way older than the COVID vaccine, right? Which is vaccines that infants and children receive to prevent some, you know, very severe illnesses that we as society have accepted, and there's science behind their safety. And so dealing with that day to day, this is what we are used to doing. The difference at the point that we're at now is that more than half probably of my patient population isn't even eligible for the vaccine. So a lot of what I'm finding is that the conversations I'm having with parents about teenagers that are eligible is, like Darian said, I may be the first provider they're talking about the vaccine with, and we may be talking about answering their questions and their concerns about themselves being vaccinated. So I take that role, you know, very importantly. I'm like, if they have not talked to their doctor, I'm there to hopefully tell them what I need to tell them and answer their questions. If they're asking me about their teenager, but they themselves aren't vaccinated yet, my suspicion is going to be that that teenager will likely not be vaccinated if we're not convincing that parent to vaccinate themselves.
Yeah, that's thank you both for sharing that. One of the things that has been brought up already about sort of this misinformation, the politicization of the pandemic, this mixed messaging from public health agencies, you both saying, you know, this could be the first time that people are talking to a provider about the vaccine, which is, when you think about it, we don't even really put that in perspective, especially with the privilege for many of us who do have access to the vaccine. But also this strategic misinformation campaign from conservative political and media leaders. And though some GOP leaders have changed their tone on vaccines, it's going to take time to undo months of spreading false information. But one of the things we're seeing is we're also seeing some doctors, right? People with a doctor in front of their name undermine the vaccine. For example, Dr. Joseph Mercola in Florida has been an anti-vaccination activist since before COVID-19, pushing alternative medicine instead. And Rachel Moran, who is a researcher who studies online conspiracies at the University of Washington, was on NPR earlier this month to talk about Dr. Mercola. Let's take a listen.
It's incredibly difficult to counter it, because when we're encountering vaccine hesitancy, our advice is usually to tell people to discuss any concerns they have around the vaccine with their doctor. But if you can go online and find someone like Dr. Mercola with a medical degree who aligns with your political viewpoints concerning mask mandates or vaccine mandates and is offering up seemingly legitimate medical advice, then that's where your trust is going. And unfortunately, we're seeing a very small but vocal minority of medical professionals who are anti-COVID vaccination. And these people often use their professional titles and their medical expertise as evidence as to why people should believe them.
So, Bianca, you've been working to spread information primarily in Spanish to your community. But as we're seeing COVID-19 misinformation target vulnerable people, what are you hearing from parents and families about this information?
Yeah, I will tell you this. I think misinformation spreads probably a lot faster than information, I think, is something to keep a close eye on, because I agree. It's very, very hard for me to sit and dispel something that they've now clicked on, you know, several different sites saying this exact thing that is not correct. And you're right. I think it's hard and confusing when you do have someone with the word doctor in front of them.
Right.
It's hard. The public sees doctor and they think that it's someone that's authoritative and has knowledge, right? And so, yes, it's hard to undo a lot of what maybe has already been, you know, months and months of seeing and clicking and YouTube videos, et cetera.
What are you seeing specifically from your community?
Right. I start, especially if it's a family I have had a relationship with, you know, I've been in the practice I'm at for close to 3 years. So I do remind them about other health decisions they've made with me in the past. And I try to start the conversation by saying, I remind you that I would not recommend you do something that I think is harmful, and that I would not recommend something that I wouldn't do for my own children. And that typically gets parents' attention. And I will tell you that I think a lot of them had said, thank you for taking the time to bring up that you're not just going to be telling us something because you're telling us, but this is something that you would do for yourself, which I have, right? I've done it for myself and I would do for my own kids. But of course, unfortunately, they're in the group right now that are not eligible to receive it.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. Darian, I've seen you be so active on social media to explain vaccines and to fight the myths. And I want your take on the misinformation, but also if you can expand it a little bit to talk about, you know, social media companies that are allowing for this misinformation to just kind of go unchecked. I mean, it feels like, you know, you're fighting this literal battle like in a physical emergency room, but then you have to fight it in a virtual space. How do you begin to tackle all that? And what is some of the specific misinformation that you kind of want to be like, oh my God, I'm shaking my head here. Like, how do you fight this back?
It is a part of my exhaustion. When I talk about that fatigue that I have, it is the fact that not only am I a full-time physician practicing, treating, and diagnosing COVID-19 every single day that I'm in the hospital, but I'm also coming home and reading about these reports from people who have, to be honest with you, never really treated a patient. And it's interesting when you see these physicians who speak on ignorance about COVID-19 vaccines and really come from a place that puts people at harm, you can often find that these physicians or these doctors are very distant from clinical care. And the farther away you get from clinical care, the more of these outliers that you start to hear from.
Right.
And I think social media serves this confirmation bias, because if we look on our timelines of Instagram and TikTok and Facebook, it feeds us what we agree with. And that is a problem that we need to fix. And I always try to remind the people who I'm talking to that we need to read beyond the headline and to check the source. But it is not the current climate of social media, and definitely not the generation that I'm trying to speak to the most, which is, you know, 12 and above, 18 and above, the people who are reasonably young and healthy and feel invincible in many different ways and don't feel as though they need to get a COVID-19 vaccine. They are the people that are looking at these TikToks and these posts and agreeing with them because they make sense. And in reality, scientifically, they often don't. And so I'm trying my best to legitimize my presence as a physician who is trained and went to school and helping people understand the complexity of science. But you have to do it in a creative way, and you have to have endurance because misinformation is a lot more stronger, capable, and long lasting than I can be. So I just try to keep up.
Yeah. So Darian, just to stick on that, this notion of you coming home, right, after another day of treating COVID, and then you open up your phone or your laptop, and then I'm sure you're shaking your head.
Yeah.
When you're like, ugh. What are some of the myths that you're hearing, and how are you being creative to be like, hold on a second, this is what you need to pay attention to, and here's why?
You know, I focus on helping people in creative ways understand risk assessment. Mm. I think that's really difficult during a time of panic and crisis. People have a very difficult time understanding risk. And I know so as a physician, as an emergency physician, mm-hmm. I'm helping people with difficult decisions every single day. And I have to do that in a way that is understandable to them. And so I try to help people understand, you know, if you are concerned about something, and we can use vaccines as an example,
yeah.
Pick a risk that you feel comfortable with. Is that 1 in 100 people being harmed? Is that 1 in 1,000 people being harmed? Pick a number that you feel comfortable with, and then decide whether or not that risk applies to the vaccine. You know, for example, the risk of rare outcomes of this topic of myocarditis or inflammation of the heart is 1 in 1 million or even less than that. But the risk of you getting in a car and getting in a car accident
right.
is greater. And so what I'm trying to help people understand is in a time of crisis, we have to take a deep breath,
yeah.
be calm, and understand the variation of risk in our options and realize at the end of the day that the risk associated with the vaccine is far less than the humongous benefit that is gained by it compared to the fact that you don't know when you'll be exposed to COVID-19 and the risk of that is far greater.
Mm.
And so I always try to help people reframe and take a step back and look at the risk of their situation. You asked about a specific question.
Yeah.
For example, most recently, there was a viral TikTok about a gentleman who was inside of a waiting line waiting to get swabbed. And he was trying to prove a point that the swab was sterilized with a specific chemical that is a known carcinogen. And while that chemical is associated to being a carcinogen, we have to ask ourselves, wait, why would this be used to sterilize? And it's because the research and literature knows that this chemical used in microscopic levels can have vast benefits in sterilization. And we use it to sterilize
yeah.
medical instrumentation. And so when people were agreeing with this TikTok, my next question is, when you walk into a hospital, are you going to choose that you don't want your instrumentation sterilized and you would rather have it not sterilized? Or are you going to agree with sterilization?
Yeah.
And you know, it's just reframing these things for people
yeah.
to understand, like, this person is picking something that is agreeing with your cognitive bias that you've decided that this vaccine is unsafe. And so you're going to agree with it, but you haven't taken a step back and looked at 1,000-foot perspective,
yeah.
which is that this is inaccurate.
So one thing that is different with the rise of new variants of the virus, and obviously we have a pediatrician with us, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, Bianca, is that more and more children are getting really sick with COVID-19. This past Saturday, it was reported that over 1,900 children were hospitalized with COVID in the United States, and this is a record high. The first few waves, Bianca mentioned this when we talked about the exhaustion, the first few waves seemed to spare children, and at the start of the pandemic, the messaging from public health agencies was that if you were young and got COVID, you would mostly be fine. And we're seeing the impacts of that messaging now, because according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, children from the age group of 12 to 17 years have the lowest vaccination rates. So talking about mixed messaging. But this gets even more complicated when it comes to vaccination, because that age group only has access to one vaccine so far, and that's the Pfizer vaccine.
Right.
In Dallas County, Judge Clay Jenkins talked about the growing crisis for children in a news conference last week. So let's take a listen.
In Dallas, we have 0 ICU beds left for children. That means if your child's in a car wreck, if your child has a congenital heart defect or something, needs an ICU bed, or more likely, if they have COVID, need an ICU bed, we don't have one.
Wow. Bianca, like you said, you're a pediatrician. You're starting to see more and more of your patients and others getting COVID. What are you seeing, and what can parents do to protect their kids?
Honestly, any messaging when it comes from a general pediatrician perspective is that we say that we realize every hospital is going to be in a different situation, right? I mean, Dallas may not necessarily reflect exactly what our situation is.
Yeah.
I think it's just bringing the importance for parents to realize that, yes, when there is more than one thing going on, and there is definitely more than one thing going on, right? We have the typical things that are unplanned things that must be taken care of in a hospital.
Right.
And so when you're seeing a surge of things such as COVID-19, resources then sometimes do just get diverted a different direction. So I think the biggest thing that we can kind of take from this urgency that gets put out there is that, yes, every different hospital is in a different situation day to day, probably probably shift to shift, bed availability changes. Mm. And the big thing being is if we have a child who is the age that they're eligible to be vaccinated, right? This is really where the push comes, is if you have a child that is eligible to be vaccinated, and we've seen the evidence that vaccines prevent severe enough illness to require hospital care, right? Then really our message is, we urge you to get your child vaccinated so that we can, in fact, take care of whatever comes our way,
right?
Whether it be, like we said, a child that's in a car accident, a child that breaks an arm,
yeah,
a child that has another issue that may or may not be COVID related.
Right. And Darian, you have been tweeting about the lasting effects of COVID, you know, and how the risks go beyond just hospitalization or death, especially for young people. Mm-hmm. I just want to share my story as a parent. I have a 21-year-old and an 18-year-old who are both type 1 diabetics. Mm. Last year, I was just like shocked. They weren't on any list because it was type 1 diabetes, it wasn't type 2. And I was sitting here as a parent going, my kids need to get vaccinated. I mean,
yes.
I don't know what the lasting effects are when you're not producing insulin.
Yeah.
Right? And so can you talk about those risks? Because I do think that's also being missed with young people, right? That it's not just hospitalization or deaths. It could be kids with, you know, other pre-existing conditions or other conditions. What can you share?
I like to help people understand that a patient that is discharged from the hospital very rarely just simply goes back to their normal life. And when people try to understand the outcomes of COVID-19, they think about it in a very binary form. And by that, I mean, oh, you either have no symptoms or it's mild and it goes away, or you have symptoms and you get checked into a hospital and you get discharged or you die. But it's a lot more complex than that. Mm. We're seeing a lot of patients who are not only having very complicated long hospital courses, and each and every day brings new problems. Their COVID-19 infection started as a lung disease, and then it progressed to what we commonly see, which are vascular complications as patients develop blood clots inappropriately and have long-lasting permanent injury. Patients are leaving on dialysis,
yeah,
in long-term facilities requiring physical therapy. I'm seeing young people who are coming back after their COVID diagnosis,
yeah,
with recurrent symptoms, as we've seen in these 1 in 3 people who have these long-haul symptoms. And they come back with palpitations, shortness of breath. And to be honest with you, I feel like it's a lot of PTSD, the trauma of feeling like they may go back into that moment where they feel like they can't breathe. And that is a very traumatic and isolating experience for the individual and the patient. And so I try to help people understand that, you know, it's not simply about whether or not you'll just get sick and you'll need a little bit of help and then you'll go home. It's about these long lasting injuries. And then also realizing that what is a cold or a sniffle to you,
right,
may be truly life altering for someone else. And that is what's difficult for people to get. I get a lot of patients who come in and they're like, thank goodness, it's just a cough. And my question is, but who did you transfer this to? You know, and that's what's difficult for people to wrap their mind around.
Yeah. And Bianca, just one specific question as a pediatrician. We talk about 12 to 17, but what about the young? I mean, I'm no longer that parent. I'm living an empty nest life in a couple of days, you know, breaking news. I have two kids going to college, but I live in a neighborhood here in Massachusetts where we have a lot of young families. And, you know, I see a lot of young kids out during the summer, and I'm talking like 5 and 6 year olds or 4 year olds or 3 year olds. What do you tell parents, you know, for those age groups?
I'm a mom of a 5 and 7 year old, you know, and I talk to other moms of that age group. And so what do you do,
yeah,
right now? The only way to really protect the younger children at this point in time is to make the curve better.
Mm.
The curve is at a point where they likely will be exposed, right, when they go back and start school, or they will be exposed when they go to daycare or when they go do, you know, an activity. So with the way the curve looks right now, it's a lot of risk assessment that you have to do as a family.
Yeah.
Me being a pediatrician, my children have had to stop some of the activities that I feel are too high a risk, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So that's the conversation we have. And again, it's just everything's going to differ between family to family as to what they feel is worth the risk.
You know, having lived through that life, all the places that your young kids are at when you're trying to keep them active and, you know, like join these activities or do this. And I stop and I'm like, yeah, your world could get smaller. Your pod could get smaller. So
yep. Yeah,
it's true. So let's talk a little bit about vaccine mandates. So last week, the Pentagon announced that vaccines would be mandatory for military service by mid-September. And starting this week, New York City residents will have to present proof of vaccination for indoor dining, gym use, and other indoor entertainment venues, though the requirement will be fully enforced starting in the middle of September. And as schools and colleges open up, institutions, districts, and elected officials are putting in place their own restrictions. So last week, Los Angeles and Chicago announced teacher vaccination mandates, and so far, over 700 college campuses have some type of vaccine requirements. Two of my kids go to places like that. We had to do all the uploads and everything. So we're starting to see these very vastly different worlds for those who are vaccinated and those who aren't. Let me start with you, Darian. What impact do you think these mandates will have? And will they create more equity gaps for those who are still facing barriers to access the vaccines?
I think this answer is quite complex.
Yeah.
Because now we're stepping into the point where people see people who aren't vaccinated right now as monolithic. They see them as having one opinion, which is against vaccines, when, as we all know in this conversation, it is a lot more complex than that. There are many different reasons why people have decided not to get a vaccine. It can go anywhere from fear of needles to medical mistrust and a history of medical trauma that may be ongoing right now, mm-hmm. to the bias that is perpetuated by this misinformation, to just an overall disbelief of COVID-19 existing. And I've met each and every one of these patients inside of the emergency room. So when I see these mandates come out, I always have a little bit of caution and trepidation, but I also realize that, you know, we have an effective tool to prevent hospitalizations and deaths. Mm. And although I want to respect the autonomy of making a decision, we also have to acknowledge that that decision affects other people around you. And when that happens, that's when we have to realize what is the difference between a natural right and a privilege to access to the community. Mm. And by that, I mean access to dining, sports, and schools. And so when we have this conversation, we can no longer let the lives of those who are vaccinated be put on hold for the deliberations and decisions of those who are unvaccinated.
Yeah.
So when people ask me, what can they say to people who are against these mandates? I simply state, again, reminding them about what is a right and what is a privilege. And yes, you have a right to make a decision about your own health, but you don't have the privilege to expose someone else to danger. I think we have to remind people of that.
Yeah.
This is not the first time we've seen something like this. As a physician practicing in New York and training in New York, for much of my time, I was in Bellevue in a lockdown unit where patients who did not or refused to take medications for the tuberculosis treatment were held and required to take that treatment because they could not get on a subway, a bus, or enter in a public space in New York City,
yeah.
and expose other people to tuberculosis. And that was very much agreed upon. That is not something that you see on the headlines every day, but there are patients all the time in those locked wards getting their medications because they refuse to take them because they are a danger to the public. And so when I make these statements, I always remind people about the historical factors about disease control, mm-hmm. and the difference between privilege and risk and access to the community. And then realizing that, yes, you can make your decision, but your decision may have negative effects of it. And by that, I mean, your privileges may be taken away until you realize what your decision is going to be. And unfortunately, that's the reality that we live in.
Yeah. And what about you, Bianca? What are your thoughts?
You know, to be in the healthcare field when starting a career in medicine, whether it is be nursing school or medical school, where you're having to prove immunity to some of these mm-hmm. communicable diseases, right? Because you will be not only you're putting yourself at risk, but you yourself may be putting that patient at risk.
Right.
Very much so had to show my vaccination record to do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the maybe people that are up in arms about it just may not be aware that this is not something new.
Yeah.
At least, like I said, when it comes to the healthcare industry in and of itself.
So let's move on to our final segment. We call it COVID coping because it actually focuses on a completely different question. And I'm going to start with you, Bianca. How are you finding joy and hope during these unprecedented times?
So I will say that even though was the hustle and bustle that was going on the work end of things.
Yeah, yeah.
Slowing down some of the, again, activities that I felt were too high a risk for some of my kids basically just gave us more time to slow down and be at home.
Nice.
So that in and of itself, I will say, has been something positive that we took out of this. And then some of the worries that I had from, you know, pulling them from some of those activities, guess what? We found other ways to interact with people to still continue that stimulation communication where when the cases were low, we were comfortable, you know, being around other families that were as COVID conscious as we were.
Yeah.
But as cases are going high, we've changed that to we're going to do, you know, Zoom or FaceTime now as opposed to gathering again. And I do think, you know, that there is a point that yes, kids need to go back to their normal activities, but I do think there's nothing wrong with kind of making adjustments along the way when there's things that are going on, like what is going on now.
Yeah. You know, having gone through it and now having seen how fast it goes as a parent, all I'm remembering are the times that I was with my kids to give me joy. So if you're having more time, those are the things that I personally feel will matter as they grow. So I love the fact that you're finding joy and hope as a mom. because I think it's so simple.
Right.
We kind of tend to forget that, to be like, oh, we're doing this or we're reading this. And it's like, no, I'm just with my kids and I have time.
Right.
I'm really glad you shared that. What about you, Darren? How are you finding joy and hope during these times?
You know, during these times, I focused a lot on self-care in terms of respect for myself, the respect that I have for sleep, the respect that I have for exercise. Mm-hmm. And I think that throughout this experience, I've gained a new level of appreciation for my own health. You know, every day I wake up and I treat it as a blessing. Mm. And I connect with the people around me in new ways, as Dr. Bianca was saying. And I've never been the one to pick up a phone and call someone. And I have certainly not been the person to FaceTime you. But now I've become that person where I feel like I have a deeper level of connection with friends outside of social interaction that are like packed inside of a crowded bar.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've gained a new level of appreciation for the friends that I do have. And then when I'm feeling that I need inspiration, I look at these community leaders in these communities that are getting people vaccinated. And it is nothing short of inspirational, right, watching these people go from door to door and explain these concepts. And I use that as motivation to keep me going.
Wow. Well, thank you, both of you, for sharing your thoughts and your insights and a little joy and hope, because sometimes it's the simple joys and hopes and blessings. And so thank you. So Dr. Bianca Soria Olmos, pediatrician, and Dr. Darian Sutton, emergency medicine physician, thank you so much for joining me on In the Thick.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
And remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because it really, really helps. Also, you can now listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts, because we're everywhere. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends. In the Thick is produced by Noor Saudi, Harsha Nahata, and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Lisa Salinas, with editorial support from Mike Sargent, Charlotte Mangin, and Nicole Rothwell. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, Leah Shaw Dameron, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We'll see you next time in the Thick family. Thank you for listening. Nos vemos.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.